Remember, whatever discipline you're in, whether you're a musician or a photographer, a fine artist or a cartoonist, a writer, a dancer, a singer, a designer, whatever you do, you have one thing that's unique. You have the ability to make art. And for me, and for so many of the people I've known, that's been a lifesaver, the ultimate lifesaver. It gets you through good times and it gets you through the other ones. Sometimes life is hard. Things go wrong in life and in love and in business and in friendship and in health and in all the other ways that life can go wrong. And when things get tough, this is what you should do. Make good art. I'm serious. Husband runs off with a politician, make good art. Leg crushed and then eaten by a mutated boa constrictor, make good art. IRS on your trail, make good art. Cat exploded, make good art. Someone on the internet thinks what you're doing is stupid or evil or it's all been done before, make good art. Probably things will work out somehow, and eventually time will take the sting away, and that doesn't even matter. Do what only you can do best. Make good art. Make it on the bad days. Make it on the good days too. And fifthly, while you're at it, make your art. Do the stuff that only you can do. The urge starting out is to copy, and that's not a bad thing. Most of us only find our own voices after we've sounded like a lot of other people. But the one thing that you have that nobody else has is you, your voice, your mind, your story, your vision. So write and draw and build and play and dance and live as only you can.
Welcome to Art House Radio. This is season two. We're back. It's great to be back. Nice little break there, but it's time to go to work. The opening segment that you heard was Neil Gaiman speaking at the University of the Arts in 2014, talking about making art. You know, in the 70s, there was a British television show on the BBC, and I don't remember the name of the host, but it was a philosophy show. Go figure. What a country, right? You have a philosophy show on one of the major networks where they just talk for an hour. No commercials, by the way. And they talked about Schopenhauer one episode. A couple of mature gentlemen, look like professors. And they're talking about how Schopenhauer, who had a very dark view of life, and how he, despite his view, his dark views, he found art to be one of the few solaces, one of the few places you could go into that could give you temporary relief from the pain of the world. And they gave an example, and I think it's a good one. If somebody hands you a plate of food, probably the reaction you have is your instinct is to want to eat it for sustenance. Maybe it's greed, maybe it's lust, whatever it is. But if somebody hands you a painting of a plate of food, you're not thinking about that at all. And if you're in a museum and you're looking at a painting of a plate of food, you sort of think about the aesthetic quality of it, the lines of it, the shapes, the meaning of it historically and culturally. And you look at it from different angles and you think about whether you like it or you don't like it or you're not sure. And that's what art is. So it took away for that moment. Anytime you step in front of a piece of art, it's sort of, in some ways, can suspend the world that you would normally find yourself in, the day-to-day struggle, all the things that come and go, the good and the bad, you know, the stresses of everyday life. But when you're in the museum, when you're in front of a piece of art, or you're experiencing art, or you're listening to it, whatever it may be, for a moment, you've got some sort of relief, some sort of peace, hopefully inner peace. And I've always remembered that. It's stuck with me for years and years now, and I just wanted to pass that along. That's why I shared the Neil Gaiman part, because I think it's important to make art. It's good to have projects. It's good to create things, which is what you should be doing. And hopefully this podcast or discussions like this will contribute to that sort of movement. All right. You also heard a little theme song there by Santos Ramos. He wrote a couple of jingles. Maybe you've seen some of the season 2 promo ads. Those are floating out there for Art House Radio. So things are happening. Today's episode is going to be fantastic, I think. I mean, I've listened to it, and I think it's pretty fantastic. I think you're going to like it, too. I'm chatting with Sophia Gonzalez, a.k.a. the Queen of Siam. You can follow her at the Queen of Siam. She's also got a radio show Tuesday mornings from 2 to 4 on Freeform Portland. That's freeformportland.org. The show is called The Upstairs Room. I highly recommend it. It's it's like a mixtape for you every 2 hours. For 2 hours every week, sorry. We had a great discussion. It went on for a long time, so I broke it up over 2 episodes. This is part one. We talk about everything from The Cure to Life to Guy Maddin to Fudgesicles. Would you like me to repeat those or just the last one? Oh, just the last one? Fudgesicles. Yeah, you're going to want to listen to this because it's really interesting. From time to time, I have some mic issues, and my voice may be a little bit lower than hers, but it worked out. It's good enough, and I try to do the best I can with the equipment that I have. So there you go. I've said it. I've just unburdened myself of my own podcast poverty. Hashtag podcast poverty. So many conversations ready to go. I've got almost a dozen already ready. So I'm going to do this twice a week. I'm going to try and be as consistent as I can. Do 2 a week for as long as I can go. You know, I have, like you, jobs and stresses and bills and all that. So, but I love doing this, but what are you going to do? All right. So let's go to our conversation, my conversation with Sophia Gonzalez, the Queen of Siam. Enjoy. So if you get up at 3 or 4, how does this, you have to get up so early for your show.
So right now, starting next week, my show is not going to be 4 to 6. Thank you, Lord. It's going to be 2 to 4.
2 a.m. to 4 a.m.
Yes.
That's better. I think that's better, maybe.
It's, for me, is tremendous because 4 to 6 is like zombie hour, and I'm not really awake. I may sound awake, but that's running on adrenaline, and that's it.
So that's it. So you have to be there at like 3? Is that?
Well, since I'm taking the bus.
Oh no.
The bus stopped running at like 11:45, so I'm there around 12:45 or 1, and then it's just up to me to make my own fun until, you know, 3:55.
Wow. Okay. So you can't be late. What happens if you're late? Is it Autobot? You should have like an auto Queen of Siam that just kind of says, hello and welcome to the upstairs room.
They should, they call that a bumper.
A bumper, oh.
I need to record a bumper, but I have not yet. And if I'm late, then the person before me has to just stay there. Someone has to be at the station at all times. Mm. So if you're dying of appendicitis, you need to call the person ahead of you and be like, I'm dying of appendicitis. Can you play for an hour or two?
Okay. That's why the bumper was created.
That's why the bumper needs to be. Yeah.
In the future, you'll just be able to, they'll give you like a secret app, an in-house app that you can on your phone. And you could just start from there. You could be on the bus and be like, hi, I'm on the 15 headed towards wherever it is in the southeast. And where this is how I'm starting the show. And then somebody at the station listens to it, and then they play whatever you say.
Exactly. I'm going to telecommute from now on from my home under my covers, and it's going to be fantastic.
It's probably happening somewhere. Telecommute radio.
Right?
I mean,
it should. If it's not, then it should.
Can,
if it is, then it will.
Can you record it? Or do you have to do it live? Like, couldn't you just go in and record it in the morning or something?
I could go in and pre-record, but that's cheating. That's cheating, and you really shouldn't do that.
Cheating? Oh, you mean by cheating, like, yourself? Or cheating that it says it's live or that the station is live all the time? Is that the motto?
It's cheating. Don't cheat.
Don't cheat. No, is that the motto of the station? Like, hey, we're live all the time. This is what it is.
Yeah, recording live from the Baker Building. This is blah, blah, blah. And you're listening to meh. That's the whole, yeah, recording live and in person because people really care at 4 in the morning. There's nobody awake. I'm not speaking to anybody. There's nobody out there. It's dead silence and nobody cares.
I'm sure.
That's fine.
I'm sure you're huge in the southeast, and you're huge probably in Detroit, and...
Okay. Oh, well, perhaps, like, the Netherlands.
Ooh, you never know. Well, in the Netherlands, it's, like, 10 a.m., so that's perfect.
Right. People are raring to go.
Yeah, you can just... That can be your pitch, that you're more Eurocentric. Sure, it's 4 to 6... in the United States on the West Coast, but really, I'm going on European schedules here. That's my audience.
My audience really is not Portland. It's for everybody in Europe, and thank you, everybody, for listening in the Netherlands, because you're the only people listening at 4 to 6 a.m.
It's fun. Why did you do
it's
this?
It's a good time.
Why the show? What got you into it?
Okay, well, they contacted me a few months ago, and I don't know why. I think they were just looking for people in Portland to do something, anything, and that's not something that I really... The last time I did radio was in my first year of college, and I had to queue up cassette tapes, which
fun.
Was a giant pain and ridiculous. And it was for a show called Blue Screen Rock. But I hadn't been doing radio. I hadn't done radio for all that time. And I thought, I don't know. Maybe I should apply, but... but I told myself this year I was going to do things that were... scary to me, or things that I usually would not do. And so I decided to go ahead and apply, and they liked my pitch. And so here I am in the middle of the night crying into a microphone. Sadly.
Scary things. I like it.
Terrifying.
Are these like resolutions, or are these just things that you wrote down in January? Like, this is going to be the year that I do these scary things.
I don't make resolutions because that's silly and nobody ever does that. Have you ever made a resolution?
I mean, I have, but not very often. Not, it's rare, and I never follow them anyway. So you should be able to make them in July. I don't know why it has to be in January. I mean, I get it. That's the full calendar year, but
yeah. No, I'd never make resolutions, and I feel like I don't know. I just thought, well, you haven't been doing anything with your life. Let's be honest. Your life's been a joke. So let's do something for you. Let's do something fun and different and a little bit scary. And it turns out it's not scary at all. Again, it's super early in the morning, and it's a free form station, so I can play whatever I want. If I want to play Merle Haggard and then The Cure, because always.
Drop acid, play Merle Haggard, and then.
Right.
Yeah.
But like you do, like one does.
Wasn't he big into that, Merle Haggard? Into the LSD experience?
Was he?
I thought that's. I had read that somewhere, but maybe not.
Let's start that as a thing, because that sounds beautiful. I love that idea. Merle Haggard dropping acid and playing songs about dogs and pickups and
just womanly. I don't know Merle Haggard that well. Should I?
Why not? I mean, it's... He was an interesting fellow. And now you tell me he drops acid or did... Or had?
Yeah, so, I don't know.
That sounds interesting.
It does sound interesting. It's like late Elvis. That guy was way more interesting than...
Oh, my God.
Honolulu Elvis.
No, Honolulu Elvis was no good. Blowout, chunky Elvis with the drug problem and the being an agent of the drug force and questionable jumpsuits, that was the Elvis to love. The sweating profusely Elvis was the Elvis to care about. He had something to say. He was living it.
Do you think that, I don't know, I mean, that's before our time, I think. So, do you think America rejected that Elvis, I wonder? I've never really looked into the history of this, but I feel like they would like Honolulu Elvis, and then by the time he got into late sweat Elvis, that he would be rejected, kind of like the Sgt. Pepper crowd. You know, they wanted, there's some of them who wanted I Want to Hold Your Hand to go on forever, and they didn't like the drug thing.
Well, I fully agree. I think America likes the facade of super happy, ridiculously overjoyed people and things and sweaty, grotesque Elvis was not something perhaps that people were willing to take easily. I love it. Everybody should love it, I think, in my opinion.
I agree.
But America loves happy, no matter how fake and ridiculous. They love the Osmonds.
Oh.
They want the Osmonds.
Yuck.
Just awful, right? Just insidious.
Yeah.
The Osmonds.
Like the Partridge Family, or... Although...
Yeah.
I don't know if you... Danny Bonaducci, interesting, or no? I don't know.
He was on, like... VH1 in the 90s or early 2000s, and he was just kind of an icky sort of figure, and he didn't, I don't know, or like Leif Garrett, like a drug addict who had a lot of gossip. That was his whole to-do. Yeah.
I wonder if they like the clean-cut versions of all these artists, whoever they are, because... That's what they're scared of the other possibilities. If you have like a family, and not that there's anything, not that people can't have families and be interesting, but if somebody has a family and they're married or they've got this the house and all that stuff, if you start to think about the possibilities of taking mushrooms and wandering the streets or just jetting off to Paris or whatever, that kind of shakes up the world that you're building. The structure, the foundation gets shaken. So it's, I wonder if they're scared of that generally.
I think most of America doesn't like a beatnik. America, counterculture, subculture is not great for normal America. That's scary to them. Something other than 2.5 kids and happy.
This 0.5 kid sounds interesting, by the way.
Yeah, the 0.5 kids is the most interesting. It's a Chernobyl thing. I don't know.
The Merle Haggards of a family.
Right. The Osmonds, the scary thing about them is that they just keep coming. Like, there were like 500 of them. There may still be. And they were all happy. And they were all...
touchy-feely with each other in a weird way?
Very. It was a little off, perhaps, but not off enough that America was like, well, they're touchy-feely, but they've got this great attitude. They've got a fantastic attitude about life and the world around them. So I think America is happy with the Osmonds, not so happy with grotesque, in the best way, in the believe me, in the very best way, Elvis, the grotesque Elvis. In the overly tight jumpsuit, that ill-fitting and kind of sad and dying in on his toilet or whatever that was.
I wonder if that just reminds them also of the end of life, like of death. Like, he was all together, clean cut. He had the uniform on in Honolulu. By the time he gets older, he's got boobs and he's just like popping out and like there's things sweating and there's all kinds of madness going on with the hair, and
right,
that's just the deterioration of a body. And I wonder if that also plays a role.
I think that who really likes to think about their mortality besides, I don't know, Sartre, or I don't know, some of us obsessed with death and the whole thing. Nobody likes to think about their own mortality. And one of the scariest things, I think, is laying a body out that has been embalmed and dressed and made up to look like they're still alive, a Madame Tussauds kind of business. That, to me, is really frightening. And that's something that most of America, or a lot of America, does, that I find just kind of horrifying.
It really is. In the
world, it's kind of like you made up a puppet and you're like, oh, he looks natural, and no, he doesn't look natural. He looks like you stuffed him, and it's terrifying to me. It's terrifying. In other countries, they take care of their dead themselves. They wash and bathe their dead, and they use oils and make sure that it's lovely, and then they chuck them in the trash, which is how I want to go.
Chucked in the trash.
I just throw me in a dumpster somewhere. It's fine. I'm not there. It's, what do I care anymore?
I can remember one of the first funerals I went to, and I saw an open casket, and I just thought, nope, that's not that person. It's not. I don't know where this... I don't know what happens when this existence or this light goes out, but that right. body, that sort of huge hot dog material, that's not it. It's hot dog in a suit. No, that's not. It's gross. It's really gross. So I don't know if I want to be chucked in the trash, but
yeah.
maybe cremated and sprinkled over the trash.
Sure. Why not? Or I hear this story. There's a urban legend, although it has sort of been agreed upon that it is true, that people in Disney World and Disneyland, they take their the ashes of their loved one and sprinkle them in the Haunted Mansion they'll just, like, I don't know if they've got a bag and they're just, like, chucking it over the side of the Doom buggy or what, but there are people interred in the Haunted Mansion. I don't know why. It's one of those. It's like the insidious side of normal America, where they're like, well, you know, this person loved this ride. Let's leave a little for... leave a little for everybody here. I don't know.
Those people sound boring. You should have, like... shouldn't it be, like, very specific to you? If you're going to get sprinkled over something, I want to be sprinkled over, say, the front yard where I grew up, even if nobody lives there, my family. It's somebody that we don't know. Or, you know, maybe somewhere in over Burnside Bridge in Portland. Something like that. Something that... that meant something to me, rather than just like, hey, at Disney, or, you know,
here's something they semi-enjoyed. Let's just sprinkle them wherever they've been, wherever they've, you know, had a corn dog, basically.
It seems that seems sadder to me than like sad Elvis, to have this life where people don't really talk. They don't really know you, so they're like, hey, he really loved the McRib, so we're just going to dump him in the trash at a McDonald's or drive through one time and get it and then sort of pay with that. It just seems very sad. Like, you never really tried.
That's life, isn't it? Sort of Bukowski is a perfect example of someone who said, just don't try. Don't try. Just do... grind away at your everyday job, get drunk as hell, and just exist, and then pork out and die. Just go ahead and do it, because that's what's going to happen anyway. So maybe that's the high water mark there.
I believe you said pork out.
Pork out.
It's racy.
It's very state fair. It's very... Middle America, pardon, really, it's a bit scary. It's a bit,
Wait, what's scary?
They think they're so normal. Just middle America thinks they're so normal, when in fact there's this, like, aftertaste of just terrifyingness. The corn dogs and the hot dog man.
The chicken fingers.
I don't know. There's a darkness there that's more interesting than the, you know, I don't know, the the facade that they try to play up.
It's almost scarier.
I do too. Everybody does it.
Sure. But the reserved parts of culture or countries where they sort of hold it in and they don't talk and they want that Honolulu Elvis, that's almost scarier than someone like Bukowski or someone who's letting loose, because it's bottled in and then you don't know when it's going to come out. Maybe that's the thing. They're trying to hold on. Like, I'm in my 80s. I want to explode from all the things I've suppressed. So to me, that feels like more tense.
It is, but it's later in life that you, when you realize how little time you have, that you do start cutting a proverbial rug in your life, and someone dies, and then you found out Granny was a lesbian, and everyone was like shocked. But that's when people do all the things that they want to do, is when they're finally like shocked into the idea that, oh God, I have, you know, maybe 10 years to live. I've got, you know, 2 years to live, maybe. I better do everything that I wanted to do now. And people just wait to do the things that they love until that fear of death or decay comes to the... How did we get on death?
I don't know. I think it was Elvis.
It always turns that way with Elvis. It's always Elvis.
But that's really interesting, because I always think about being older in like 70s and 80s, And that's the time where you're finally retired, maybe. And you have all the time in the world, and now your knees don't work. So you can't go to Alaska, or you can't go to the Himalayan. You can't go to Chile. You can't do any of the fun stuff. You're old. And you did all that work to save up so that you could basically go to, you know, Denny's at 4 o'clock for dinner every day. That's your treat.
Exactly. You're living in Boca Raton. And you're at 4 p.m. You have your same meal. What is it? Like a country fried steak. Mm. And maybe a little heavy. I don't know. And then you go home and I don't know what people... I have no idea.
You press your blue pants.
Right, for the next day.
Yep.
And I think that's it. You go to bed at like 8:30, 9 o'clock, maybe earlier, depending.
Yeah, but it's similar to that in that that's the time where now you've got all this free time and you also have a chance to do all the things that you were afraid to do that you should have done when you were younger, but you maybe didn't want to take a chance because you had bills to pay or you had a wife with or a husband and you got two kids and you always thought like, hey, I'd really like to suck a dick, but I can't. I've got this whole family thing. Or if you're a woman, you're like, I really want to be an artist and run off to Belgium, but I can't. So I'm kind of stuck.
Right. Then what do you do? Then what has your life meant? What are you doing? Why exist? Why, what are you doing with your life? What are you doing with your life, Troy?
I don't know. I'm not...
What's going on?
Well, I don't want to suck a dick. Let's just put that out there. That I'm okay if, okay. I'm okay if that happens everywhere. I don't want to run to Belgium and be an artist.
No?
I don't think so. I like Belgium. I've only been to Brussels, but I didn't get a feel for the city. I don't know. I'm sure it's fine. I don't know. I don't know. What do you want to do?
Before I die,
or just
for that, you know.
How about one of the scary things that you said this year? Is that going to be a trend where you come up with scary ideas that you want to confront?
I'd like to say yes, but probably not. I would say that I've lived my life in fear of pain and rejection. That's the overwhelming view that I've had is that fear of rejection is worse than dying just after eating at Denny's and going to bed at 8 o'clock and then dying sweetly in my sleep.
Fear of rejection is worse than that.
Oh, far worse. Because it's immediate. You dying in your sleep. Well, that's a dream. That's wonderful.
I wish there was a way to know what people were dreaming when they died in their sleep. I wonder if in the future you'll be able to download your dreams and then you can see like, oh, it was this. Like, everybody gets murdered in their dreams when they die in their sleep.
That's really a scary thought.
Oh, it's terrible.
You're a very frightening person, I must say, to even imagine such a thing. I would hope that it would be your family and friends saying, hey, like, welcome.
Oh, I see. That's better. Yeah.
Or your ancestors saying, well, here you are now. We've been waiting to meet you or something like that. Probably you're just knocked out and nothing happens. I have no idea. I really don't know. I'm going to do something that scares me because now it's scary. Now it's becoming a little bit frightening to me. Thank you for whipping me into shape, Troy. I appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome. You should just add that to your list. Every time you go to bed, just think, when you think you might be dying, just start thinking about, you know, the scariest last dream ever.
I love dreams. People hate hearing about people hate hearing other people's dreams.
I'm half and half. But I love
half and half.
Yeah, sometimes I like to, if they're interesting, I like to hear them, and if they're not, then I think they're boring. I don't dream. I just go to sleep and I wake up. Sometimes I'll dream, but not very often.
I think everybody dreams every night is what I hear.
Yeah.
But But it's the remembering that's the important part, yes?
Yeah, that's what I meant. I don't remember my dreams. Yeah. I just wake up.
I have really cinematic, visceral dreams.
Guy Madden type dreams?
Perhaps Guy Madden. Perhaps Guy Madden. I don't tell anybody, you know, because nobody wants to hear it, so I hear. The only one that I told that people have been interested in, again, rejection, is the Pope Squirrel, which happened, which... do you know about the Pope Squirrel?
I don't. No, please.
Okay. So I dreamt that I was in the Guggenheim. Oh, God, everyone's going to hate this. I dreamt that I was in the Guggenheim, and I was running quickly. You know, the Guggenheim is just one big ramp up to the top.
Sure.
And I was running for some reason. It was a very important... I was there for a very important reason. I didn't know what it was. I get to the top. There's a broom closet. I open the broom closet. There is a squirrel in a Pope outfit. He has the mitre and a little swingy thing, a giant ring on his paw, and he's giving rites to just some dude. He's standing on a pillar giving rites to some dude, and I'm absolutely mortified to have stumbled upon this and accidentally ruined someone's sad, happy time, whatever. So I back out of the room, like, bowing. I kiss the Pope Squirrel on his ring, because that's what you do when you meet the Pope, is you kiss his ring.
Can I just say, I love this squirrel already. Go ahead.
This squirrel was a crushed red velvet outfit. He was very, very regal, an incense holder. Just a sight to behold. So I close the door, and that's the end of the dream. So I tell this to a friend, and on my 30th birthday, I am presented with, this is real, I'm presented with a Pope squirrel. They found a taxidermied squirrel in Brooklyn and, like, sewed his outfit, and now that was my dreams literally came true. This is the first time my dreams ever came true. So now I own a Pope squirrel, and he's won many awards. He's very prestigious. Yeah.
I don't know what that means, but
yeah.
I love the idea of the squirrel, especially because squirrels tend to be very timid and unsure and uncertain of things, but this squirrel was, like, confident, and people were kissing his or her ring and bowing in front of this squirrel. So that if you're a squirrel and you've got confidence, you could go a long way in the squirrel world, I think.
You could, and you should. Squirrels out there listening to this wonderful podcast, go out there. Be yourselves. Be stunning. I don't know. I don't know what the dream meant. That's not the kind of thing you find in a dream dictionary.
No,
honestly,
it's not. And the Guggenheim is interesting. I don't know. I guess that's where you'd go if you were some sort of a Pope squirrel. Pope rodent. Are they rodents, squirrels?
They are rodents. Ooh. Indeed, yeah. They are. So actually, a few years ago, I went to the Guggenheim. I ran all the way up, and there is a broom closet. It was locked. So who knows what doings are happening behind that door.
I'm smelling some sort of Bruce Nauman type sculpture of a Pope squirrel. Pope squirrel's got to appear now in the Guggenheim somewhere. If anybody happens to listen to this in New York, you have to put a Pope squirrel in the Guggenheim.
His name is Pope Pine Nuts II, and he deserves a place in the Guggenheim. Of course, right. What else would you name a Pope squirrel?
I think that would be really interesting. One time, I love it when weird things appear like that aren't necessarily part of museums, but they appear kind of like Rogart, you know? It sounds like I'm saying a French poet, Rogart, but like rogue art, art of the rogue.
Right, Rogart, yes.
I was, you know the Tin Drum, the movie The Tin Drum?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a very scary movie.
It's a very scary movie. So I was in Paris once walking out of the Louvre. Pretentious alert, I was walking out of the little triangle, you know, the IM Pay thing or wherever you walk out.
Yeah.
And I looked up on one side, and up on the top of the roof outside on the Louvre, there was a little tin drummer boy with the drum and everything just sitting there. It was a mannequin, but it was a little tiny thing just sitting on the edge with the drum. And that's, I thought, I don't know if I took a picture of it or not, but it's haunted me forever. Like, if only I saw it. I know somebody else saw it, but scary.
You may have been dreaming. This may have been something. That's really scary. It's very Parisian to do something like that. Just shock the hell out of you when you least expect it. A little pretentious, but we're going to let it go. This is as I understand it, this podcast is all about being free. Free as hell.
Yeah, that's the only tin drum story I have, though, so I've got to throw that out there.
Well, I got a million of them.
Let's hear one.
I don't have any. I watched the film. It scared me to death, and that little child was very scary. I don't know what to say. It's a frightening film. Everyone should go see it.
They should see it,
Everyone should see that film.
I think you're one of the... I mean, the boy was really disturbing in it, but one thing that always... It didn't bother me, it just shocked me, is the... I don't know if you remember the moment where the father... The mother's gone, I think, and the father gets, like, a young girl, like a 17 or 18-year-old girl, to be, like, the maid or whatever. And then there's a scene where he comes in and he's fucking her on the sofa.
Yeah.
And I always thought, like, oh, my God, that's creepy. Like she wasn't a little girl, I don't think. I think she was probably of age, but it still was so weird because he's, like, a middle-aged guy, like 50s, 60s, something like that.
It was wholly unpleasant. But I think that was the point of the tin drum, was to sort of shock you out of, I don't know, out of complacency, but out of, I don't know what the movie was about.
I don't know either.
I have no idea. I watch a lot of film. I love a lot of film. Half of the time, I don't know what the hell's going on. I just love to watch and be, I don't know, be taken on some sort of bizarre journey.
Challenge.
Like Guy Madden. Yeah, challenged, for sure.
Yeah, I definitely love Guy Madden. I wouldn't know about him if it weren't for you. I've been watching some interviews with him lately, actually.
What do you think? What does he say?
I watched one interview where he was talking about whether or not... They were asking him questions about Winnipeg and whether he liked it. And it sounded like he was very... He hated it when he was younger. And now he likes it, but he still kind of hates it. And
yeah.
I don't know if he lives there or not, but I get the impression that it's kind of a bleak place. Sorry, Winnipeggers, if that's... It's got to be very cold there, right?
It's extremely cold, from I understand it. And there's... In my Winnipeg, that film My Winnipeg, he says that it's the sleepwalking capital of the world, which is interesting. And I don't know what that means, but it is very bleak. Have you seen My Winnipeg?
Yeah, I watched it on a train once in the middle of winter going from Portland to Michigan.
Right.
Yeah, you had suggested it, and I took it on a train ride with me in the middle of winter. Perfect place to watch My Winnipeg.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sleepwalking. That's strange. Why?
The sleepwalking capital of the world. I don't know.
I wonder if that happens in remote places a lot, if there are any statisticians out there who can say, like, hey, this is typical in sort of remote places or cold places, or... Probably not. I don't know.
But I think I used to sleepwalk, and any time someone asked me while I was sleepwalking why I was sleepwalking, I would always tell them that I was looking for something. I didn't say what I was looking for, but I always just said I was looking for something.
Mm.
I don't know what it means. Maybe they're all looking for something. I don't know. I don't know what they're looking for. Warmth or something. Companionship. I don't know.
Thoughtful in dreams as well as in life. On the search.
Exactly.
Can never get any rest from the constant search for looking for whatever it is.
Always, always wanting something or needing something or desiring something. Did I tell you I met Guy Maddin?
No. Whoa.
Like recently. So they showed The Saddest Music in the World at Hollywood mm-hmm. Theater here in Portland.
That's the one with Mark McKinney and yes. Isabella Rossellini?
Yes.
Great one.
And it's it's one of the best films ever. And he was there introducing it. And while introducing it, I'm sorry.
That's all right. This is real. This podcast is real. We're just going to go with
it. It's on the reel. It's on the reel. Did we get that taken care of? Fantastic. Okay. So I met him, and he was just talking about the film, but less so about the film and more so about just like Winnipeg. And afterwards, I had a book. It's called In the Atelier Tovar, which was sort of a memoir diary. You feel like such a voyeur reading it. And it was the first time I had ever been starstruck in my life. I was waiting in line with my book, and my tongue fell out of my mouth. I could not, it was really embarrassing. It was embarrassing because you want to say something meaningful. He's such a fantastic figure and interesting, wild, enormous figure in my life and in film. I just stood there like a teenage girl, just like a teenage fan. It was really embarrassing. I just said, I love you and your movies. Will you sign this? And it was just a disaster. Now, I met him before. I met him once before at a Canadian bar in New York City. Mm. And I whispered something quite profane in his ear.
Is this like the movie? I was also drunk. What's the movie where Bill Murray whispers into Scarlett Johansson's character's Lost in Translation? Is this like that? Where you can't tell us what you whispered?
I'd rather not.
Okay, we'll leave it between you and Guy Maddin.
Right, it's a whole thing. It was just filth, really. I was drunk, and that's how it was. But he's such a warm person. For someone from such a freezing climate, he's such a warm, shy person, and so thoughtful. Just his movies and his writing are so interesting and thoughtful and odd, and just he's just the sort of person that you need to get for this podcast. Not me, sir, but Guy Maddin.
That would be amazing. Oh, it'd be fantastic. I think that the first thing I watched was The Saddest Music in the World. And
right.
By the time I saw that in my Winnipeg, I was just so impressed with the technique of this. It would be a nightmare to be an editor on one of his films. But so interesting the way that it's constructed, because it's not just a normal film with the sort of the shots. There's so many things. He's like using a completely different language almost.
Absolutely. It's very expressionist, and it's very funny, and it's sort of frightening. And he's got such an interesting point of view, and he works in such an interesting idiom that it's he's wholly different from any other filmmaker. He has a unique sense of self and point of view, I think, and I don't know, he's just such an interesting guy, and just talking about him, I feel like sort of, I don't know, just like a teenage girl. I'm such a fangirl for Guy Madden. It's really, Guy Madden, if you're listening to this, I love you, and I'm sorry for being a jerk that night.
That would be great if he remembered that, sitting in his Canadian bar in New York. Why do the Canadians have their own bars in New York? Is that a thing in
That's
all
what
cities?
I
or? There's not one in Portland. I
think there's not a Canadian bar in Portland that we know of.
That's true.
I think everybody has their own bar in New York.
That's, yeah,
you know, if
probably.
You're Canadian, you want to sit with Canadians and bitch about Canadian things or be impressed with Canadian others. And it was just like a lodge. It was fantastic. I don't know if it still exists because nothing still exists in New York. But it was a special time, Joy.
It sounds like it. I'd love to have him on here. If I'm ever lucky enough to have him on here, I won't bring up the whispering in a Canadian bar in New York, but I'm gonna try to like construct it, like, you know, just smartly, so that he goes, you know, this one time, this girl, you're not gonna believe this, and I'm gonna like, really? Let me hear it.
Some filth. Right. Oh no! Don't bring me into it. I don't want anything to do with it. Did you happen to see his new film?
Ugh, no.
What's it called? I brought it up and can't remember what it's called.
This year?
So he had Keyhole. And did I tell you about seances?
No.
Oh my God, Troy, I have done you dirty.
Where can I see this?
You can see it on the Canadian Film Association website, I want to say.
What?
So seances, what were you saying? Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just...
Okay. It's incredible. So he was obsessed with the idea of lost films. So there's all these films by famed directors that are lost to time, that someone spilled coffee on or were just thrown into garbage because someone wasn't thinking. And we have the names and we have the storylines, but we don't have the actual film. So he was obsessed with remaking them.
Wow.
And so he did. And so he remade them. And Seances is an interactive website where you conjure a film. And there are different films put together in a specific way so that they only play one time and then they're destroyed. So you're getting one short film, about 15 minutes, 20 minutes, that is just for you, the one that you conjure, and then it is destroyed forever, never to exist again. And it is so overwhelming. I'm not afraid to say that I watched it. It was fantastic, so strange. And then I teared up a little at the end because this is never, it'll never be seen again. And he's just one of those amazing thinkers that would do something like that. It was powerful. I mean, I'll give you the address later, but
yeah,
that's
amazing.
It was. He's an amazing man.
Because we were talking earlier about being afraid until you're old and not trying, and you're holding on to life and you want to believe in heaven or whatever so that you can continue doing the boring things you're doing now. But that's destroying a film, giving it one play and then destroying it. That's the opposite of that. That's, hey, this is just for you right now. We're going to have a moment here for 15 minutes and then it's going to be gone forever. Because that's how it's going to happen anyway in life, usually.
Exactly. I think that the idea of having a seance, knowing, actively knowing that if I watch this, it's going to be no longer. Should I do this? Should I actually be complicit in destroying a film for my own pleasure and my own, you feel sort of, I don't know.
What if it turns out, yeah, go ahead.
No, you feel sad. You feel like maybe you shouldn't have done it. You feel like maybe you shouldn't have watched it. And it's very powerful. I'll give you the address later so you can put it on. But yeah, interesting. He's a rare artist for sure.
It's the idea of experiencing something like that is overwhelming almost, because you don't, like you said, you don't know if you want to enter into that experience. Because what if what if it's the greatest thing you've ever seen? You could never watch it again. What if it was the greatest film ever made and they're like, you can't do this. You can't destroy it. You have to keep it going.
No one else can ever watch it again. You're the asshole that destroyed this film. And it is overwhelming. It is a very overwhelming experience. Guy Maddin, what a dude, what a guy.
I wonder if there's also something to the idea of the way, I'm sure that's, he's making a comment about some of the things we're talking about, but also movies tend to, at least in outside urban areas, get one play and they're done. Like in a lot of places, especially where I'm at, there isn't a lot of interest in playing old movies or underground movies. And it doesn't make any sense to me, because you're just going to let it go for 2 weeks to 3 months in a theater in 1996, and then it's never going to be in a theater again. Why? If you're sort of doing the Guy Maddin thing here, but I don't think there's that much thought behind it. I'd like the idea of revisiting things if it's not intended to be destroyed, of course, if it's not some sort of very thoughtful artistic gesture. So right. I wonder if there's a thought behind that, like just Hollywood pumps these things out, they destroy it, they play some more. They might as well destroy it because it never gets shown again, except for in DVD form or Blu-ray form or whatever, Netflix.
Right.
But that's a different experience, right? Going to a theater.
It's going to a theater is it's a very sexy experience, isn't it? It's very
it is.
You shouldn't be there. You shouldn't be there alone with strangers viewing some sort of, I don't know. It's, but that's what makes it. The sexiness and the mysteriousness makes it worthwhile. Even though the raisinettes cost you $10, it's worth it to go and be a voyeur with 30 other people and watch something that doing something you've never done and doing it for the first time. Doing things for the first time is always a little bit scary and sexy, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I never thought of film that way, but I think I always have subconsciously that, I don't know, the sexiness part, I haven't until now, but the intimacy of it, yes. Where you walk in and you're sharing this moment with complete strangers. You're watching something that could change your life. And usually it at least changes your day. You come out of movies, I think, not the same person you were going in, even if you hated the film.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, it is. It's, you probably, it's like a, you know, it is a peep show. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And that's what I so enjoy about it. You're in the dark with strangers viewing this thing, and maybe I'm just a pervert. I don't know.
It sounds like it.
But I find it right. But I find it a really enjoyable experience. Something like that is. You're doing it probably once. I saw The Witch twice, but it was still.
I haven't seen that yet.
You? Oh, Troy.
I know. I know. I'm so behind.
It's the most painterly and poetic horror film that I have seen in years and years and years and years. Oh, it's really worth a watch.
See, that's probably why I'm not a huge horror fan film, but you are.
I am. It's more psychological. So it's about the Puritans, and we have no... Watching it, you just feel like, well, you are an outsider. It's something that you, almost incomprehensible that you're watching these very religious people doing these very superstitious things so that God will look down upon them favorably. It's also done in like old English, so you're a complete outsider, and then all of this weird stuff is going on around it. All this, it's a coming of age story, it's a psychological horror film, it's a history film, it's art, it's all of those things, and that's why I really enjoyed it.
Sounds great. Are there subtitles then if it's spoken in old English?
It's not, and so teenagers fucking hated it. They couldn't understand it, and they just rejected it wholesale because they couldn't understand it, and there are no jump scares, there are no infrared cameras, no one's running around like a fool, and there's no white people going down to basement stairs where they shouldn't, and you're like, this is ridiculous. So
no hockey masks. When you said that it was a horror film, I thought like, okay, well, that I'm not usually into horror films. Your description of it makes me want to see it, but when you said the word pilgrims, that really scared me. I think they're really scary. I don't, probably because of their history, but the idea of going back to that time period and walking sort of on the woods or around there and seeing a bunch of pilgrims, and what a scary fucking time. I'd be scared to death of pilgrims and natives and everybody, and I just would want to like run away and hide in a cave somewhere.
If you were to be manifested to that time and place, with all the knowledge you have now, it would be absolutely worthless there. That's the terrifying part, is that everything you know now, and I consider myself okay with the smarts, and you are extremely intelligent, and you go there, and it would all be for naught. Like, it's just, and the people are sort of terrifying, and they would burn you alive for no good reason, and the pilgrims were... And there's a whole colonialism thing, which is just, it's very, not great. Let's call it not great.
Yeah.
Colonialism. The movie is, it's scary because you almost can't understand it. You go in with a weird point of view that makes no sense in the same context. So I think it's great. I think you should see it. Everybody should see it, I think.
I should see it. I think you're so much more plentiful in the smarts than so many people. I question your ability for recognizing my smarts, because I do a lot of stupid things.
Well, so do I. Stupid is something that I do very well. I'm just really clumsy. I don't know if it's the same thing, but I can't walk.
You can't walk. Okay.
I'm always tripping over something.
That sounds more like a motor skill or an alcohol thing. But I know you don't drink, but...
I drink. I'm always in a reverie. I think that's my problem, is that I'm always thinking of being somewhere else or doing something else than what I'm actually doing now, which is terrible and the opposite of... practicing mindfulness, which I should be doing, but...
Well, maybe that's why they say the world isn't for dreamers, because then you run into things while you're looking around thoughtfully, wistfully.
Right. It's a very wistful... I'm a fucking moron. It's not for dreamers. Truly, the world is not for dreamers. Those who dream, trip over their shoelaces and... Everybody laughs at them. Rejection. We're back to rejection.
Thanks for listening. Arthouse Radio is brought to you by people like you who go to our website, arthouse43.com. They click on donate, and then they make a one-time or a recurring donation. Anything you could give, anything, would help. Artistic projects are never free. Creative projects are never free. So any support you could give would be greatly appreciated. Listen, remember to support us on social media at arthouse43. That's Instagram and Twitter. Facebook.com/arthouse43. You can visit the website. Please subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play. We're on every major platform. And maybe write a review or click on a star. How hard is it to click on a star? Just one click. It would take, like, I don't know, maybe 20 seconds for you to get to the website and then click on a star. And it goes a long way. If you can't donate funds, then maybe you could just donate some stars. We want your stars. Hashtag. I'm going to start putting hashtags at the end of it. Why don't I put it at the end of it? Well, maybe I'll start doing that. Well, listen, part two with the Queen of Siam's coming up in a couple of days. I hope you enjoyed this. I look forward to being here with you this season. I've got a lot of people coming up in conversation. It's going to be a great season, and I hope you have a great day. Please don't be an asshole. Be friendly. Enjoy life. You never know when it's going to be taken away. You never know. Until next time, friends.